Okay, so just a quick slide. These are the people I have been working with. They are excellent collaborators. If you have the chance of meeting them and working with them, I really encourage you to do it. And let's go straight to the point. So this was the status in 2019 for the constraints on primordial black holes as dark matter. And well, black holes this heavy are the ones that LIGO could observe, but they are heavily constrained by the CMB, depending also on the assumptions that you make about how these primordial black holes will accrete matter. Okay? And here on the left, there were these constraints that people had some doubts about. And in fact, there were a couple of works. One of them is this one by Andrei Katz and other people at CERN. And this one by Montero Camacho and other people from Ohio, I think, which actually show that these constraints do not exist for a variety of reasons. If you want, I can tell you a little bit. So this one here is a femtolensing of gamma ray bursts. And the problem with this bound was that basically the finite size of the source that emits the gamma rays was not taken into account in the lensing calculation. And in order to put a constraint from these kind of events, you need gamma ray bursts that have a surface that is very small, and we don't have them. So unless we find them, we cannot put this bound. Okay? And these ones here are based on the capture or collision of primordial black holes with stars. And there were several uncertainties here. One had to do with the ratio at which these events could happen, which of course will depend on what is the abundance of the primordial black holes. And then on the physics that happens when the primordial black holes goes inside the star. So it was thought that they could trigger, for example, the explosion of some of these stars. And basically, by counting them, you can put bounds on these primordial black holes. But again, there were very large uncertainties in these calculations, and it has been argued that these bounds don't exist. Okay?
The fact that there is a sharp cutoff in this Subaru-HSC,
Yeah.
is probably because they don't know how to model between the boundary.
It also has to do with the modeling of the optics, yes. So in the beginning,
realistically, it cannot be like that, no?
no, it is not so strong. It will go up in some way, but you don't know how to compute it. So yes. And this one here, I didn't mention it, but this is the bound that comes from Hawking evaporation. So black holes that are very light take a short time in comparison with the age of the universe on average to radiate their energy, and they evaporate. So
what happened at this 10 to minus 11 PBH solar mass that
here?
Yeah, to separate why the computation fails on the left and not on the
I
right?
can tell you the details. I don't know. But it has to be with, I think, with the light tracing, depending on the size of the source and on the lens and these kind of things. But I don't know. Okay. And yeah, I added this band here, which is a bound that you get by comparing the number of events seen by LIGO with what you would expect if they were the dark matter. Okay? Eva, you have a question.
Can you just repeat what you just said?
No, I said that this thing here that I put on top, this purple shade, this thing. That's the bound that LIGO puts on black holes of this mass, which, as you see, is very strong and tells you that you cannot have black holes of, let's say, 30 solar masses. That will explain more than 1 per mil of the dark matter.
That's just by the rate that LIGO
Sorry?
doesn't see enough of them.
Sorry? It's just by counting the number of events.
LIGO doesn't see enough.
You should see more than what we see,
Yeah.
We don't. So that's so simple. It's interesting, though, that LIGO was really what triggered the recent activity in this business, but in reality, we've come to realize a few years later that, in fact, where you should be looking if you're interested in dark matter is here, not there. Okay? And I can tell you later why this happened, but it's a long story. Okay. Yes.
So, I'm under the impression that most of these curves say all of the dark matter are many black holes of a certain mass, right? Or are they?
Yes.
There assumed distribution?
No, all of these curves, that's right, thanks for the comment, they all assume that all the black holes are of the same mass, right?
And I guess the same person that yelled that at me once said, if you let there be a mass
yes.
function,
so,
most of these go away. But I don't know what the
well, it depends a little bit on what is the precise bound that you're looking at. Some of the curves change a bit, but not too much. And also, in most of the models that we have for producing them, you will see that you produce them at a very specific mass, general. And also, this axis here is logarithmic, so this means that in the end, the bounds are. I mean, this is just, of course, a limit, but it is. A good representation of the status today.
Okay. Do you think it's possible to open up a window
here because of no?
Because of the what you say?
No, I think so. I don't think so. No.
For the full dark matter.
No. But maybe other people think differently, but I don't think so. Okay, so this is the first message. If you're interested in primordial black holes as dark matter, you need to look there. Okay. Yes.
So I just missed, you expressed that there had been some doubt about the neutron star. That something happened between 2018 and 2019 that definitively said those neutron star bounds should be ignored or wrong?
At this paper.
And what was the...
Well, they did an analysis of what happens with one of these neutron stars gets a primordial black hole inside, and they studied the physics of this, and they found that the outcome of those encounters will not allow you to put this kind of bounds, because the stars will remain there as you would expect without primordial black holes. Okay, but don't ask me the fine details of the calculus.
There's other bounds there that you
yes.
took away as well, the femto and the white dwarf.
The white dwarf, similar to the neutron star, right. And this is the femto lensing I was talking about that had to do with the optics analysis, okay? So these two, in a sense, are similar. This is a different kind of physics.
So the essence of those is that if a neutron star catches a primordial black hole, people thought that would destroy the neutron star, and so that would affect the missing neutron star.
Yes, in one case, the black hole is captured, in the other one, passes through, but it can trigger a nuclear reaction. And depending on how you model that, you get different bounds. I think now there is an agreement, the people that really have done these things, that this was over, let's say, optimistic. Yeah. Okay?
Sorry, could you remind me maybe I just didn't understand, but what's the decay rate as a function of temperature of the members?
Function of temperature of the universe?
Well, how quickly do they evaporate? I'm trying to see.
Okay, so for 10 to the 16 solar masses, okay, that will be black holes that basically evaporate today, okay, roughly speaking.
Today?
Is that -16?
Did I say 16? Okay, sorry, -16, yes. Okay, so let's suppose we are interested in this and we want to find out how to form them. And the very basic idea for the formation of these objects is that you suppose that these circles here are supposed to represent different Hubble patches, and one of them has an overdensity by a certain amount, okay, at certain distance scale, okay, which is this curve here that represents a fluctuation. When this fluctuation becomes of the size of the horizon itself, then the whole Hubble patch will collapse to form a black hole. And this is supposed to happen typically during radiation domination. This is the basic picture. Okay? So while these patches will continue expanding, this wall will collapse. Like that. Now, how big has this fluctuation to be in order to trigger the collapse? So there are numerical estimates from numerical relativity that tell you that it has to be essentially order one, one half. Okay. Now this is an approximation. There are more sophisticated analyses that you can do, but this is the order of magnitude. If you go down and consider the order of the typical fluctuations that you have, that we know from the CMB, it is much, much larger. So if all the fluctuations that we had were of this order, the formation of primordial black holes will be very suppressed, okay? Because we will have very little fluctuations of this size. Yes.
So this 0.456 comes from the numerical relativity.
Yes.
I assume they're assuming that horizon entry is happening during radiation domination.
Yes.
Does it change at all if horizon entry is happening during something else besides radiation domination?
Yes.
How much does it change?
So if it is happening during matter domination, which would be the other stream you can consider, well, I cannot tell you what is the exact value, but what I can tell you is that the abundance of the primordial black holes that you produce is much, much higher than in the case, parametrically different than in the case of radiation domination. And in fact, the whole process of the collapse is described by different physics. I will discuss a bit more later.
You said delta C has to be larger?
Sorry?
Smaller. Delta C has to be smaller.
For matter domination, yes. Sorry, yes. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so this is the cartoon of what happens. I will focus on inflation for the generation of these large fluctuations. They could come from something else, but we will consider inflation. So suppose you have some mechanism that during inflation generates a large peak in the primordial power spectrum. And then when this fluctuation re-enters the horizon during radiation domination, you will form the black hole, okay? That's the idea. So as I said, it is the whole Hubble patch that collapses to form the black hole, and therefore this is the mass. It's just the density, average density of the universe at that time, multiplied by the radius cube. And if you use Friedman's equation here, essentially, then you get to this relation, which tells you that to form black holes of 10 to the minus 14 solar masses, which is in the window I was discussing before, you need that the peak of this primordial power spectrum is at a scale that is very, very far away from the scales that we probe with CMB or large-scale structure, many orders of magnitude. Okay? And in terms of the number of EFOLs, you can convert this formula into this expression. For example, for a black hole here, I'm using a different benchmark. For a black hole that will be of the order of a solar mass, the peak has to be generated around 18 EFOLs after the pivot scale of the CMB, so 0.05 inverse megaparsec. Okay? So let's say 20 EFOLs after CMB scales, just to get an idea. That's for a solar mass black hole. Okay. These ones, it's even later.
This corresponds to what epoch, what moment in radiation domination, what typical temperature?
This is very model dependent.
That or the solar mass, for example, you were saying, that example you were giving.
Around QCD phase transition.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, there are people that have argued that if you had a phase transition there, that will diminish the equational state. That could favor or enhance the production of primordial black holes.
Well, it's not about the transition, no? It's about...
Well, the QCD phase transition, yes.
QCD happens
yes,
to be
it does
a
happen,
drop
yeah.
in the effective number of degrees yeah. of freedom with standard model.
There is a paper by Chris Bynes on this, for example.
You know how... So here, the setup is that this is all collapse happening on the horizon scale.
Yeah.
How important is that? What if the collapse... black holes can form on sub-horizon scales as well.
Yes.
It's not necessary that they have to be horizon scales. How sensitive is the analysis to that assumption?
I think So that the collapse will happen later, you mean? The problem is,
for example, right? It could be on smaller, or they could be, yes, it could
happen. Well, larger, no, because they need to be in constant contact. This is the idea. So, I mean, right. So the whole region has to talk to, the different parts have to talk to each other in order to have the collapse. So that's, but the collapse is not that it happens really instantaneously when the fluctuation crosses the horizon. I mean, there's a whole process. You just use this this threshold when the fluctuation enters as a proxy, if you want to compute the amplitude, the abundance. But what happens later?
The key is it's really tricky to grow a primordial black hole using subparametric physics, because you end up with too much angular momentum. You end up with too much tangential motion. So if you're trying to, you know, start with some kind of overdense region and then grow a black hole,
yeah,
you don't end up with a black hole. You end up with a virialized structure. You really need your pure radial collapse to get a primordial black hole, and that generally only happens when you're got stuff, you're entering the horizon and immediately falling in, because that region is so overdense. It's not something, it's really tricky to organically grow it, because you have to be so spherical and have no tangential motions.
So there will be no energy release, like everything just...
Well, I mean, basically you need some kind of dissipate, some way to ditch angular momentum. Or, you know, we form black holes in our universe, we make stars and then they form black holes. You need some way to, if you're just trying to do it with some kind of dissipated dark matter, you can't cool it enough to dissipate its angular momentum enough to actually get it to collapse to a point. It will more likely form a halo. That's why we have halos. and so it's really difficult to do it with sub-horizon physics.
So I agree with that. It's just, but there could be dissipative processes, right? And you don't have to do it with...
If you have some way, you know, to effectively make a star and have that star collapse, that kind of process, you know, get the matter concentrated enough so that, you know, it cools enough, so you got it concentrated enough so you effectively have a collapse of a star, then yes, of course you can make a black hole.
The reason I ask is just I'm trying to understand. So here there is a probability associated with having a large fluctuation at the scale of the horizon, in some sense, right? And then there is another small probability associated, okay, how likely is it in some region to form an object because of some dissipative process? Is it obvious that this is generally more efficient than that? So they're both small numbers in some sense, so it's not clear to me a priori. And it's probably, it seems likely that this wins out, but I don't know if people have really...
So if Scott were here, he wrote a paper about like actually growing primordial black holes during an early matter dominated era. And that paper really did find that, you know, basically it only works, the constraints on primordial black holes through that are actually weaker than if you just primordially do it directly. And you still need a blue tilted power spectrum to do it, because basically there is a suppression due to the tangential motions. Instead of selecting which horizon volume, you have to select which region is spherical enough to have so low tangential motion that you can actually have pure radial collapse to a black hole. And those odds for a generic power spectrum are actually lower.
That's what I was asking.
Yeah.
But are you talking about a phase that goes before the standard radiation domination?
Yeah, or? Like a phase before standard matter.
Yeah, I actually will talk a little bit about that later.
Sorry.
Why did your argument not move to the horizon scale? Like,
well, basically the horizon scale, it's a battle, as I understand it, and you know, kind of have to do numerical relativity to really see it, but at the horizon scale, you enter the horizon and you immediately see a gravitational potential. And if that gravitational potential is strong enough, then it's basically overwhelming, you're not pulled in any other sort of direction. Whereas if you're sub-horizon, you've got mini Gaussian fluctuations, you're a little bit pulled over there, a little bit, basically there are tidal forces at play that torque you up and give you this tangential angular momentum. But if you enter the horizon and your whole horizon volume is overdense and you fall into the horizon, then basically the perturbation sees that immediately and falls.
No, but it's not necessarily like that, no? Because you could have also collapse during matter domination. So suppose there is a phase of matter domination mm-hmm. before radiation. Mm-hmm. Also there it's the whole thing that collapses.
The whole
but,
horizon
bar. Yes, but there it is important what you were mentioning. What is the asphericity of the shape of this fluctuation when it enters the horizon?
Right.
So how well it fits inside the horizon, let's say.
Right.
That's the thing. And the difference is that in matter domination, you don't have, well, yeah, physics is in one case you have pressure and in the other not. That's the...
Because what my point is that in the numerical relativity, we're just not seeing that process happening at the horizon scale, even with large overdensities.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, I think this probably goes back to my question about the mass distribution motion, that, if you have this picture of the mode entering, right, there's nothing, it's not a one-dimensional problem, right? It's not a coherent mode that
right.
has a beautiful Gaussian peak, even when it enters the horizon, it's aspherical.
Right.
And I think that plus you have other effects at horizon size that stop things from collapsing so quickly.
So you kind of doubt that delta C 0.45 number.
I doubt's the wrong word. But I will save that till later.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yes.
I guess maybe you hadn't gotten to the slide yet, but I just want to object anyway. you wrote this as if it were an issue of the power spectrum and not needing to be blue or whatever, or have a huge excursion. But it's really about the tails of distribution, so it's really something that's sensitive to the non-Gaussianity,
yes.
which can easily have heavier tails than Gaussian. So
yes.
So this beta, this expression for beta is not general.
You still haven't heard what I have to say, but yes. No, what I was going to say is that this is indeed just an approximation to what happens. This is the assumption of the fluctuations are Gaussian, okay?
And then it might be a bad approximation.
Well, it depends on the model. It depends on whether you have non-Gaussianities or not, essentially, right?
But it's only for Gaussian.
Well, this is Gaussian, yes. I mean, this is a,
Yeah, I mean, it's always non-Gaussian at some level. There's spectator or standard model fields around doing whatever they're doing, and one had better calculate the tails of the distribution accurately before coming to any conclusions.
Especially if you're going so far out.
Yeah, because you're going so far out. And I'm not saying anything one way or the other about the...
Well, I mean, if you have a model of inflation, you can go and compute what is the non-Gaussianity in that model. Mm-hmm. And then you can try to put this in this calculation. That's what you can do. Typically, what you find is that depending on the size of the non-Gaussianity, you can enhance or decrease the abundance with respect to this number here. Okay. All I'm trying to say is that if the fluctuations are reasonably Gaussian, this will be a reasonable approximation. If they are not, then it won't work.
No, but I agree.
Well,
what does it mean? Because since you have to probe so deep in the tail, you have to quantify that somehow, no?
Right, exactly. The ones we observe in the CMB and large scale structure need not be detectably non Gaussian at all to have the tail be enhanced. So that's all that's being said here.
The ones, sorry, did you say that again? The ones we see where?
It's not that you can say there's some bound on, the 3-point function.
Of course not.
And yeah. that translates into whatever.
But if you have a model which you can use to compute, you can compute the non Gaussianity, right? Regardless of whether it is at CMB scales or at smaller scales.
Yeah, but you'd have to, again, not compute the usual low point correlators, but instead this distribution.
Of course, yeah. Yeah. But people have to start with something. So they started with this. This is the analogy, typically, that you would do if you want to describe this in the simplest term, an analogy to how a halo forms. Okay, you say. Have a peak somewhere which is dense, and then it collapses. What's the probability? Well, if fluctuations are Gaussian, you have to integrate from the threshold to infinity, and that's it. And I completely agree with you that this is the tail of the distribution, and the estimate may be wrong because this is exponential, so it's very sensitive to the value of this sigma here. I completely agree with that, but it's a first order estimate. And I will argue later, actually, that in the kind of model that I'm going to discuss, although it probably has an effect, you can very likely get the very same results just by changing a little bit the parameters of your inflation, okay, model. And I will show you why.
Is there a generic rule of thumb that you could use to quantify how little your non-Gaussianity has to be so that you do your computation? instead of looking at the tail, or this is not quantum theory?
I don't know a rule of thumb.
Sorry,
yes.
You guys can answer this. If it's a single, if you just do single field inflation, not coupled to anything else, there will be some non-Gaussian energy in the tails. That people have done that estimate, and there's that. If you just don't couple to anything, it might not be realistic. But that doesn't. In that case, as is, if it's slow roll, single field inflation.
It's typically not a slow roll. It's not a slow roll.
I think
mean, you will see this later.
There it's not big. So you need to consider couplings to other things to actually.
For what?
For generating the non-gaussian.
I'm coming to that. You're all both going very fast.
I'm not sure if general single field might have this already, but yeah, once you couple to other fields, that gets more interesting field theory problem.
So what's your question? If you need to couple to generate a large fluctuation?
No, it was not to generate a large fluctuation. I'm just trying to sort of build at this, trying to get non-Gaussian in the tail. What is the minimum thing that? So you don't see it as
you don't want to get a non-Gaussianity. That's not the goal of the game.
Well, the setting is asking in single field slow roll inflation, the non-Gaussian is irrelevant, right?
Yes.
So this calculation is a very good approximation.
Yes.
In standard single field inflation, where F and L is epsilon.
Talking about a single field,
yes.
Slow roll inflation, also the amplitude of the power spectrum is irrelevant. No,
exactly.
I understand.
Let me give you guys, because this came up and it's normal things. I mean, there's this old story in kind of the Russian literature about endpoint correlation function, just in quantum field theory, and they were thinking about it in part of it. So classically, those are n factorial enhanced, and the question is, quantum mechanically, does that survive or not, and what is ultimately the formula for it? And actually, it's difficult for single fields interacting, you know, as they do in particle physics models and in, you know, say, single field inflation. It's a well-defined question, but it's not actually as easy to answer as it may sound. The tails have to do with a high Fourier function. But as we all know, in multi-field inflation, things it becomes ultra-local and it's actually more computational control. So it's in that context that's been most studied as far as I know.
I see.
But it could well be that it's all, you know, generically still too small or whatever, but it's just somewhat non-trivial field theory. So, as I understand it, I mean.
Okay. Okay, so, well, we discussed already this formula quite a bit.
You said it was a discussion.
Yes. So I pass to the second one. The second one says that the variance of these fluctuations, if the fluctuations are Gaussian, you can approximate it by the primordial power spectrum, okay, at the scale you're interested in. And that's why, well, and this is why, because essentially you're connecting the fluctuations in the radiation density with the ones in the primordial curvature perturbation. So this is where this number comes from. And this is also part of the algebra. And this W here is just a window function that you put to smooth out your fluctuations, okay, at the scale that you want. So, well, this beta, I don't think I said it, what this represents is the fraction of the energy density of the universe that will collapse to form primordial black holes. And as you see here, this fraction need not be very large in order to account for all the dark matter, okay? So this thing needs to be of this order in order to get all the primordial black holes you want to have omega dark matter, okay?
Because when you produce them, it's a very subdominant component of the,
exactly,
energy of the universe, because it's very early in the history.
Exactly. And then, if you do the math, you find that the primordial power spectrum, assuming Gaussian fluctuations, it has to be of the order of 10 to the minus 2, which is much, much larger than what it will be at CMB scales, which we know is 10 to
the minus 2. Is that the 0.1 you put as a threshold before, or that's not related?
Of course, it has to do with this, yes.
How sensitive is that numerical number to delta C?
This number is very sensitive to this. It's exponentially sensitive.
What, like, if it was 0.4, 2
it will change a lot.
Are we talking, what is the magnitude down here?
Well, I mean, you just plug it in here and see what you get, but it's a lot. It's really a lot. Yeah. So it's very sensitive to the threshold, for example, and also to the value of sigma. Yeah.
What took the value what?
Sorry?
I didn't hear it. You took the value?
No, I said that the abundance of the primordial black holes is exponentially sensitive to the threshold for the collapse. So this makes more worrisome the approximation, if you want.
Would you, suppose we were off by some number because we realized the delta C is different, wouldn't it just essentially mean that you would have to change the time when this forms to again account for
No, the time what is going to change is what is the mass, because that determines when the scale comes inside the horizon. In order, so if you want, you can compensate a change in delta C with a change in sigma, okay? So if you lower delta C, you can raise sigma accordingly to keep the same abundance.
Okay.
So in the end, all these things are, I mean, once you have a model, you can play with the model. If you tell me, for some reason, I know these numbers because I managed to compute them in my laptop yesterday afternoon. Then I tell you, okay, give me the numbers and I give you what are the parameters of the model that will give you the abundance that you want. This is easy to do, okay? So that's why I don't want to focus so much in which are these values. What is important is the order of magnitude of this thing, and I tell you, it can go a little bit up or down, but okay. My point is how to generate a fluctuation that is this large, knowing that at CMB scales it's much smaller. Okay, this is the question. Yes?
In those equations, the n, that would be the mass of the black hole at horizon. Mass of the volume at horizon entry.
Yes.
You would expect the black hole to accrete some in that time. So that wouldn't necessarily
in which time? In which time?
Well, so I at some extremely high redshifted during radiation domination, I enter the horizon, I form this primordial black hole, and now have this primordial black hole. It's still in now a bath of.
But you form one black hole per Hubble volume at that time.
At that time, but then the Hubble volume increases.
Yes.
And so that black hole is going to start to accrete.
Yes.
Do you have radiation from the...
But it will accrete very little, right?
Why?
Well, I mean, the universe is very empty, no, at that time.
It has a path of radiation everywhere, so the question is if there is a sizable effect of accreting that picture.
You mean from the... I don't think so.
There's nothing else you can agree.
Yes. No, I thought maybe later in later epochs.
Are you meaning matter domination?
Yeah, I mean.
Well, the history of the universe. How big do these things grow?
So you mean exactly. How much does the mass change since formation till today?
That is the question.
That's
I'm
the question.
Yes.
Okay.
I would think a fair amount.
I would think little, but
Well,
you're right. Yeah, I mean a halo accretes roughly as A. So if you put a primordial black hole in a matter dominated universe and let it grow, it roughly
as A. You mean as the scale factor?
As a scale factor, yeah.
Yeah, but with some number in front, right? Which I don't know what it is.
Relatively, I mean. I'm more familiar with like ultra compact mini halos, the halo primordial black holes. But those are generally, the expectation is they will increase linearly with A starting in matter domination. So you're going to pick up a factor of, 3,000 in mass.
Isn't there like formulas for this?
Yeah, that's what I'm just pointing out. I think there's a disconnect between the black hole formation mass and the mass we'd actually be looking for.
But it doesn't have to do with the mass of the object also, somehow?
No.
No?
It grows proportional. I mean, it's a linear relationship.
And also with the fact that these things are extremely small in size, like,
Well, that's what I'm asking.
I mean these primordial black holes are like the size of an angstrom, okay?
Right, they're really... Okay.
So,
they form, they probably accrete a whole bunch, but then it probably drops off.
They're much smaller than I'm used to thinking about, so maybe I'm thinking more of the solar mass size black hole.
It's not like,
Yeah, so maybe it's just the cross section for the collecting stuff is so small.
With the solids.
Yeah, you're right there. Okay.
Okay.
The universe is pretty homogeneous still at the quality time, for instance. You know, sorry, or even when CMB decoupled, for instance.
Yeah, it's going to eat out. It's from the rest, right?
I don't know. To me, it's a reasonable question.
We can try to estimate it.
But why wouldn't it be from the rest?
Is it from the rest? With no angular momentum?
Yeah.
So it just eats out its local universe and then.
Yeah, in radiation, yes. Okay, so let me go on, because otherwise, what time did I start?
There are
cookies. Cookies are three pumpkins, so that's.
Anyway, so what do you want to ask to your inflation model if you want to produce primordial black holes? So what I just said, I mean, well, you can produce them, but if you want to explain all the dark matter, that's what you need. Then they have to be in this mass range. Then, of course, you need enough inflation, because inflation is there not to produce primordial black holes, but for other reasons. And you have to be in agreement with the CMB, okay? And already in 1994, these people were thinking about this question before LIGO and all this recent craze. And they basically draw by hand in their paper this potential, which has a region that is very flat, okay? And that's a simple idea that you can do. So now it's a little bit different, because a potential as steep as this one seems to be here will not fit the CMB data because of primordial gravitational waves. But still, the logic is going to be the same. So the intuition is that the power spectrum gets enhanced if the inflaton slow rolls very slowly, okay? And that's what's going to happen typically if the potential is very flat. In reality, this calculation is not reliable, and you have to compute the spectrum mode by mode, because the field goes too slow for this to work, actually. But it serves to have an intuition of what's the idea, okay? In fact, the mode that gives most of the enhancement in the model I will discuss now is not really the usual one that gives you this approximation, but the other one that typically decays, okay? So,
excuse me.
Yes.
I should have thought that the relevant period was at the end of inflation, and that's when the disturbance would generate gravitational waves.
Gravitational waves?
Yeah.
So what do the gravitational waves have to do with this?
Black holes, sorry.
Okay.
Black holes,
okay.
Which then you see via gravitational.
Right. Well, or not, or you may not see them, yes.
But that time period can be very short.
For the formation of the
black holes.
Yeah, so the black holes form after inflation.
Yeah.
But the fluctuations that trigger the formation are produced during inflation. Okay? In the same way, essentially, that the fluctuations we detect with the CMB that we think are the seeds for the galaxies are produced during inflation. I'm just talking about fluctuations that are produced at a later stage of inflation, but not necessarily at the very end. We have like 50 or 60 folds of inflation. We can see with the CMB, a large scale structure, about 10 of them. Then we have all the rest to play with the inflaton potential or with the dynamics of inflation to get larger fluctuations. That's what I'm trying to do. Sufficiently large that will trigger a collapse into a black hole later on. Okay, so these are papers that started to appear in 2017. And I just wanted to list them all that have to do with this kind of model, which is the one I'm going to discuss. And I hope I haven't forgotten any of them, because people can get very, very sensitive. And this is what you find if you go to Inspire and you search for the words primordial and whole. This is the number of papers as a function of time, okay? And well, you get the trend. This number here is not real. It's just my estimate of what will be following this this curve. We will see at the end of the year.
You get a trend with a feature.
Well, yes, this is because LIGO was in 2015. Okay, probably. Anyway, so. Yeah, I mean, you may see this as positive or negative. History will tell. It could be just a fad that will go away in a few years, or it may not. But this is what is happening, okay? So typically there were 30 per year. Actually, it was funny because there is like really a plateau, and then... Okay, so this is the kind of potential that you need if you want to do canonical inflation. So this potential has to be very flat at large field values. This is what we know from the CMB that fits the data best, okay? And then at the smaller field values, so a few ifs later, you need a region that is even flatter than this one. And this is the tricky part to produce this thing here. So this part is easy, and there are several ways to get it, and one of them is just to couple the inflaton to the curvature scalar, okay? I guess you all know this, but if you don't, you can easily check that if you do a field redefinition of both the metric and the scalar field, when you have a phi to the 4 potential with this coupling, then you get something that is asymptotically flat, which is what you want to fit the CMB. And this is, for example, what happens in this very well-known Higgs inflation model. Okay, Higgs inflation is just nothing but this at the core.
But even if you don't have such a strong coupling as the one you need for Higgs inflation, you can also easy the problem. You
know? Well, yes. Oh, the thing with the Higgs is that we know what is this coupling. That's why. So, with the Higgs potential, this is the quartic coupling of the Higgs. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about any scalar that has a potential like this with some coupling, whatever that is. Then you just choose this other coupling accordingly, and you get the right amplitude for the primordial fluctuations and the scalar spectral index and the tensor scalar ratio. They are all in agreement with the CMB. Okay. In fact, okay. Let me stop there. And now the question is, how do we get this thing? So there are a couple of ways that you can think of. This is one. So this is the same potential I was telling you about here. And if you consider any field theory model, in reality, you know that couplings run, okay? And this is a simple parametrization of how they run logarithmically. And I can tell you more details about how to get this precisely if you want in concrete models. But the idea is that if at some scale the coupling is roughly of the same order as its beta function and the derivative of its beta function, then these terms can compete and they can generate the kind of feature that we want. And although this might seem a little bit strange, it's not so strange because, in fact, it's what seemingly happens in the standard model precisely if you extrapolate the potential to very large field values. And in that particular case, it is because the value of the top quark mass and the Higgs mass are in a specific ratio. But this doesn't need to be the Higgs, okay? This is one way. And we worked this out in 2017, when it was still unclear what happened with these bounds here for the abundance of primordial black holes. And we chose the parameters of the model in such a way that we will essentially touch the bound. And as you see, we already got there the mass that is now interesting for dark matter. Okay. And what is peculiar about this is that this is the range of masses that you get not by tuning the couplings of your inflationary model, but by requiring that you get enough inflation. Okay. It already leads you to this range of masses. And the reason is that this potential, you cannot bend it at will, essentially. Okay, by fixing what happens at large field values, you are already constraining the freedom you have at smaller field values to produce this feature. Okay, so with that potential, you cannot get masses anywhere. Okay, they really come here.
You are characterizing the coefficients on that expansion you show with beta and beta prime from some cosmological observations?
No, I cannot do that much, no. Because, as I said, you have to compute the spectrum numerically, and it's very, very difficult to relate the properties that you want, which is the position of the peak and the height of the amplitude, to, for example, the scalar spectral index. I don't know how to do that. But if you do a numerical scan, that's what you find. Okay. With a caveat, which I will comment later, which is that the scalar spectral index becomes a little bit lower than what the CMB tells you, but it can be solved. Okay. And the other thing is even more pedestrian, if you want, which is just putting a fourth order polynomial. Okay. And this is enough to have this this inflection point region at small field values in the same way as the other one. Okay.
There is no analytical formula you can use to make the prediction, similarly to the fact that when you are in a slow roll, there is this formula. Mm-hmm. Now you will enter into some other regime, no?
Yes.
Say ultra slow roll. Is there an ideal formula available in the market now?
To describe what exactly?
The growth of power spectrum, which is what you are looking for here.
So there are several studies of describing that numerically. So for example, numerically and analytical. In the last one, so people have been concerned, for example, with the question of how fast can the primordial spectrum grow, because there seem to be bounds on that. And what we did in the last paper, which is studying this potential actually, is to try to get an understanding of the shape of the spectrum that I'm going to show now analytically. So we can understand the shape very well, but the absolute, so the exact values of the peak and the position and so on, you need a little bit more of work. But the shape, we can get it. Yes.
I think other people might have worked on this already, but you have. If there are ripples on the potential,
yes.
Do you get, in some sense, when you're stuck on top of the ripple, you are in ultra slow roll and there should be very rapid.
So, in fact, in all these. In all the models here, or most of them, what really happens is that this region here is not monotonic, okay? There is a small, this is what we actually found is doing this numerical analysis for this potential, but it is a generic property of this model.
This gets stuck, going uphill.
Well, it is really this uphill going that slows the inflaton a lot. In fact, I will show you a plot now. So. This is what we get for this potential, okay? These are two different predictions, and the difference between the two is that in the one that with the dashed line, what we are including are small corrections from higher order operators that you may have. And we made an estimate of what is their effect, and this is the effect, okay? Yes? No? So this is the kind of spectrum that you get. Okay, these are CMB scales at the far end of the plot on the left, and this is typically 10 to the 14 or so, which is what we saw before that you needed in order to get the black holes in the range of masses that we want. And the dashed line is what you will get if you use the slow roll approximation to compute the spectrum. This one here, okay. if you use this one, then you get it completely wrong because there is a point in which the derivative is zero, so it blows up. And the other one leaves you couples of orders of magnitude away from the peak or event three, and it also misses the position of the peak. Okay. So you have to compute the power spectrum numerically, or to have a very good analytical approximation, which we still don't have, but we are getting close. And that's what we did in 2017, but here I'm showing it for the more recent case of the polynomial potential. And this is actually your question. So in this plot, what I'm showing is two things simultaneously. So the blue curve is the potential itself, okay? And the red curve is the derivative of the inflaton field as a function of the number of e-folds. And it's negative because the field is decreasing as the number of e-folds accumulates. And these dots are set in such a way that they separate intervals of equal number of e-folds to 5. Okay? So here the inflaton is going slower than here, where it is accelerating, just because it's becoming to the part of the potential that is a little bit more steep. And then you see that the velocity then becomes very close to zero, and you start to accumulate red dots here, and that's because the dynamics is exactly what you just said. When the inflaton is climbing up the potential, it slows very much, and this is what gives rise to the enhancement in the primordial power spectrum. Okay. However, you enter in a regime that, as I was saying before, you cannot describe with a slow roll. Okay. And the reason why this happens is that the sign of this term in the equation for the fluctuations switches sign. Okay, so what typically is a friction term in your equation becomes a pumping one. Okay, so if you go to the limit in which you neglect this term, which is super horizon scales, this has two solutions. One of them is a constant one, and the other one typically decreases with time. But in here, what happens is the opposite. It grows, and it actually dominates over the typical constant solution. Okay?
The equation is exact, really?
Yes. And the reason why that is happening is because so these are the slow roll parameters. Epsilon becomes very, very small. But the second order slow roll parameter grows a lot, or in absolute value, because the derivative of epsilon is very large. Okay, it's this sharp change in the first slow roll parameter which triggers this behavior and produces the peak.
In this case, you're also going to get this fact that at this point, doesn't this produce quite large non-Gaussian effects? Because you're violating slow roll essentially, and I thought ultra slow roll inflation also gave you a squeeze limit.
It produces non-Gaussianities, yes.
And then your estimates for the masses are using the Gaussian
formula? No.
No.
No. People are still trying to work out how to compute this one.
But you showed some pictures.
This one that I did was without non-Gaussianities.
Oh, so this is using, you just
yes. No, when I said no, is that I don't include the non-Gaussianities to produce this thing.
Okay. So, but the non-Gaussianities in this particular model will be sick.
Well, some people have estimated them, yes.
Okay.
And I cannot tell you yet how much they affect the result. Sorry. I cannot, yeah. But my point is the following. So the peak of the power spectrum, I think, will be in the same place, okay? And the mass of the black holes will be the same. What can change because of the non-Gaussianities, I think, is the abundance. Okay. However, this abundance, I can control it just by playing a little bit with the parameters of my potential. Okay. In fact, there are multiple choices, if you want, of parameters that allow me to do this.
If it's exponential dependence, that's going to be a very
yes.
Question.
But also, well, yeah. Yes, to some extent it is. Yes. But it's also because of this freedom that I can confidently say that with the model I'm going to be able to get all the dark matter, regardless of whether there are non-Gaussianities or not.
So in this calculation, do these parameters A2, A3, A4 run?
A1, A2, A3. This one, no, these are constant here.
Why is that?
Because I assume they are.
I mean, he's just assuming local tensor.
Yes. What? Well, he's running at least an order of magnitude.
Why?
He's running an order of magnitude in 5, at least. Right.
Oh, that's fine. Well, how long is the plateau? And
very small, yes. But this is irrelevant for how much they run or they don't, no? They could run more or less depending on the on what this field is coupled to. I'm just assuming they are constant, okay?
So why did the lambda of five fourth work?
Because there I'm assuming that the running is important. I mean, these are both different parametrizations, if you want, okay? I can tell you models in which this one will run as I want it, and there are many of them, many possibilities. In fact, you just have to couple the inflaton to another scalar and to fermions, for example, okay, or a Gauge boson. And here I just assume that they are constant, is a good approximation for the whole of inflation. But people have done much worse than this, okay? I mean, this is really the state of the art.
Can I follow up on the answer?
Yes.
So, 'cause that equation you said was exact. Looks like it has slow roll parameters and stuff. But
yes.
Forward.
Yeah, but it died. Ah, okay. No.
The one that, the missing one.
What is it? It went away.
It looks like this is getting big. That the power spectrum is getting large. And I worry about
the equation is exact. It's exact.
No, right. But you're linearizing R.
Yeah.
I'm linearizing.
Linearizing the curvature perturbation.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. But do I have to worry when I see R?
Oh, that's fine. I mean, it's large with comparison to the CMB, but it's still a small number, okay? So 10^-2 or something like that. So the square is 10^-4. Yes.
So that when you predict it seems to be a narrow range, but it's really dependent on the inflation scale.
Sorry, louder please.
So the mass range you predicted for the PDH is kind of narrow according to your plot, but it should depend on inflation scale.
You mean here?
This one or the other?
This depends on where this plateau is located. You're wondering about the width of the...
Yeah, the location, the center of the peak.
Which peak of them? This one?
No, the next one.
Next one? This one?
No,
the other direction?
The distribution of the peak.
So what happens here?
Yeah, so it seems your prediction is in a relatively narrow
direction. Yes.
To the TVH.
Yes.
Does that assume a particular inflation scale, or it's not very specific?
Well, it's... The reason why this is narrow, it's because the abundance is exponential with respect to the amplitude of fluctuations, okay? So if you look at here, this peak is not really very broad. So the most of the mass is going to come from the peak. And as soon as you go a little bit away from it, the abundance will decrease very significantly, okay? Because of that formula that I was showing of beta that depended exponentially on the height of the power spectrum. Okay, that's the reason why. Now, so that's general, okay, for any parameters of the model that you choose. What is really controlled by these numbers here is the position of the peak, okay? Also the amplitude, because you have to tune them if you want. You have to adjust them in order to get this dynamical behavior that I was showing exactly in this slide. Okay. Oh, this was very slow. I don't know what's going.
Why did I do computer?
No, it's not okay.
Technology is page down.
Sorry.
Technology I mean, you can always use page.
Yes, I know that, yes. Anyway, so what I was saying is that, I mean, of course, not any potential that you draw with random coefficients will produce this kind of dynamics. You have to play with them, okay? But the narrowness of the peak is generic once you have done that, okay?
But being compatible with CMB, can I still choose
parameters
I place in a different window?
No. That's coming next. If you want to get the CMB correct, then you are forced to end up essentially there, okay? Where I have put the
so
not no, you cannot play. And if you want, this is a prediction of the model, okay? I mean, it's harder to produce heavier black holes because you need to have this plateau closer to the part of the potential that explains the CMB. So you have to have a sharper turn in the shape of the potential. Whereas for lighter black holes, you can do this a little bit farther away, and then it's easier. And in fact, this is what forces you to be there once you require enough inflation and a correct value for the scalar spectral index. Okay. So let me go on just a little bit. So now, maybe this is related a bit to your question. You were saying, okay, what happens? Somebody said you're linearizing the equation for the fluctuation. It is true, and in fact, what you can see is that at second order, you induce a stochastic background of gravitational waves because the scalar fluctuations couple and they can generate these tensor modes. And the frequency of the modes is trivially related to the scale at which you have the peak of the primordial power spectrum, which is what gives you the mass. So you can correlate, in principle, primordial black holes of a certain mass with a stochastic background of a given frequency. And this is known since many years, okay? And this is just an example of what you get for the specific polynomial potential that I was showing you. And the frequency is such that, in principle, you can see it with LISA or BBO. And this is the amplitude of the signal if you require all the dark matter to be in primordial black holes. Okay? What is interesting it is that it is above the signal that you would expect from binary black holes and binary neutron stars. Okay.
Just related to what Pete and Zach and I were working on, this looks loud enough to perhaps have an integrated gravitational wave content that could change that effect.
Right? It's okay with that.
No. It's just small.
Next generation CMB.
Yeah.
This is consistent with NF.
Isn't that about the size that we were seeing that it would be an interesting thing if you integrated it to see when you might get a
yeah. Monster. I mean, if you required a much larger peak to produce the total abundance, then this could go up. But with this estimate that I'm doing, it doesn't. So.
So this has sensitivity, that's very good.
Sorry?
Is that the red dash curve that's a ELISA?
Yes.
It's comparable to DESICO and BBO?
Yeah, I don't know where you took it from.
I think this is, this is like a second ELISA stuff, no?
It's
too optimistic, this?
It's too optimistic, I don't know where you
took it. Where would it be?
It's like 2 × 10⁻³.
Here?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. Still is the same, right?
Yeah, I think that. Well, if you want to talk about BBO, it's usually even better.
Better than this one or better than this?
Yeah. BBO is 10⁻¹⁷, the projected.
So low? Okay. Yeah, I will check then. Okay. Thanks.
Some of them are not, time integrated. That would be.
Oh.
But that's also why ET looks weak.
I honestly don't remember where we took them from.
I don't know, if it's not time there, cannot be that LISA gets better than the other threshold we are saying.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, let me go on. What I wanted to say now is that if you forget about wanting to explain the dark matter and you still are interested in this potential for some reason, you can also see, in principle, hope to see a signal with advanced LIGO. Okay? However, the black holes that will correspond to this signal here are much lighter, so they will have already evaporated by now. And they are compatible, though, with these bounds here, which come from BBN. Okay? But the point is that with these kind of potentials, in principle, you can also get a signal from second-order induced gravitational waves that perhaps LIGO could almost see. Okay?
So now, with your potential, you are capable of putting the distribution at a different mass scale?
No, I'm saying if you forget, sorry, but then you don't explain the dark matter. It's just to say that if you play with the parameters, you can still get a large gravitational wave signal, but you cannot explain the dark matter.
But you can shift the scale at which they are produced.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. But here I'm only focused on trying to get a large signal here. Okay?
No, it's just before I understood, maybe it was my misunderstanding, that given your parameter space, if you satisfy CMB.
If you want to have all the dark matter in primordial black holes.
If I want to have all the dark matter and satisfy CMB, I'm forced to have what you showed before.
Yes, I mean, but you see, this thing here is much, much smaller, this beta here. The other one had to be 10 to the minus 16, okay? Here I'm also imposing the... So there are three requirements. One is fitting the CMB, the other is getting enough inflation, and the other one is getting a peak that is sufficiently high. And part of the constraint on the position comes from the fact that you cannot make the peak grow indefinitely fast, okay? So you need some certain range of EFOLs in order to reach a certain
height. So when you sacrifice that, you can shift the range at which you produce the
because,
PVA.
And this is partly due here to the fact that I'm requiring a lower value of the spectrum, okay?
So what about PTAs?
I don't know yet.
Yeah. So you are thinking about it.
Yet. Okay, so I said that in the logarithmic model, in the one with the logs, the scalar spectral index will become a little bit smaller than what Planck says. And this is in fact a generic feature of all these potentials actually. Okay? But it is easy to solve it. So this is typically what you get with all the requirements that you want. And this is like 2.5 or 3 sigma away from the central value of Planck, okay, just Planck, which is this one. However, there are ways in which you can overcome this. And one very simple one is just to include higher order terms in this potential, for example. So a very small coefficient here, which will be, if you want, natural in comparison with this one, is enough to change the potential at very large field values and make the spectral index compatible with Planck without changing at all the shape of the spectrum at low field values, so keeping the same predictions for the abundance and for the mass of the primordial black holes. Okay? This is one way. And the other way has to do with N-effective, actually. So NS and N-effective are correlated. And you can get the lower values of NS if you allow for smaller values of N-effective. And there are cosmologies where this can happen. For example, if neutrinos don't decouple as we typically think they do, and if the reheating temperature is low enough. Okay, this you can do. Yes.
Does the discrepancy go away if you relax the assumption that black hole make up all the dark matter, or is it still there?
Which discrepancy? It goes away.
It goes away. You're assuming
yes.
That all the dark
yes.
matter
goes away. Yeah. So, now I have a couple of things more. Can I go on a little bit or not? Very quickly. Like very, very quickly. Okay. Well, if people are bored, we can close it. Eh? Okay, so I will go faster now. So you could think, okay, now let's forget about playing with potentials and let's try to be more generic and let's focus just on the fluctuations, still without entering non-Gaussianities, and let's see what can we do with a generic equation for the evolution of the fluctuations from this axiom, which is the most general you can write for a single field. And there are a few quantities here that are new with respect to what I was discussing before. So one is this sound speed, which is, if you want, the speed at which the velocity, the scalar fluctuations propagate. For this, you need things that are a little bit more complicated than just a canonical scalar field. You need a kinetic term that is not the usual one, for example. And you could also have a mass, okay? That comes in some models too. You can do a very similar analysis just by redefining your time appropriately and defining this Mukano-Sasaki variable also appropriately. You get an equation assuming the mass is equal to zero for simplicity that is exactly the same that for a canonically coupled scalar field, with the difference that now this quantity here that we were discussing before does not depend only on the first and second slow roll parameters, but also, for example, on how this quantity varies in time, okay, the speed of sound. And in the slow roll limit, then this speed of sound ends up in the approximation for the primordial power spectrum, so therefore reducing this with respect to the speed of light can also enhance the power spectrum very significantly. This is one way. And this was just what I was discussing before, that this is the usual solution that corresponds to this approximation, but then we have also this mode, and this is the one that that really will give rise to the peak if you make CS small sufficiently fast, okay? And then you can try to put this in the context of some framework that allows you to make more general predictions, and this is what people were doing years ago for non-Gaussianities and still are. You may hope to do something similar for primordial black holes. And what you find is that if you want to keep the validity of your effective field theory while making the sound speed very small, so hoping to produce the primordial black holes by reducing the speed of some of the fluctuations, then you probably enter in a conflict due to the fact that the perturbativity of the theory breaks down and you don't know anymore what you're computing. However, this bound, which is the one that leads to this constraint, relies on a number of assumptions, and one of them is a slow roll. So one will have to go and see what happens in the ultra slow roll regime and when things change in time to see if this still remains, okay? But there are ways in which you may hope to evade this kind of bounds still within an effective field theory framework, which amount, for example, to including a new scale that will allow to decouple the relation between these two. Okay? And you can play the same kind of game in more complicated models of inflation. One of them is solid inflation, which is a model in which you have three scalars that are coupled derivatively. And what is interesting of this in the context of primordial black hole formation is that in this case the speed of the fluctuations enters in the slow roll approximation for the power spectrum of this variable, not this one, because they are different in this case. That is the one that will matter for us as 1 over the velocity to the fifth power. So that means that a small change in the velocity will allow to make a larger change in the spectrum, which potentially can be useful for producing the primordial black holes. Okay, but again, there you find some unitarity bound that may compromise your hopes of getting something phenomenologically interesting from there. Has to be checked. And just to conclude, I will go very, very, very fast. As we were discussing, there is this nasty exponential sensitivity of the abundance with respect to the threshold of the collapse and also to the height of the primordial fluctuations. This is why non-Gaussianities are important. One way we thought one may hope to solve this is actually related to your work. And this is something that I was discussing in 2016 with Rafael, who is unfortunately not here, and with Alex Westphal, which is that if you have a potential that looks like this with many minima, you may not have to tune the location of the minima, because you know that when you slow roll down here, you are bound to be stopping one of them eventually, okay? And the one before that one is the one that you will hope might produce a large enhancement of the black holes. So this will perhaps allows us to reduce the tuning that you will require in the parameters to generate this feature. And you can in fact produce a spectra that look like this. So in some of the minima, the fluctuations will be small, but then they will increase, and at the end inflation will stop in some of these minima. Okay? And this is some more recent work. And then there's another nice feature of this kind of potential, is that if you go and zoom in any of them, they can be approximated very well by a phi-square potential. And if the inflaton is coupled to other species not very strongly, you can have a phase of matter domination when the inflaton is oscillating there after inflation in any of these minima. Okay? And as we were discussing before, this can reduce the height of the spectrum that you need to produce all the primordial black holes that you need for dark matter.
Can you, in this and all the other examples,
yes,
do you find it interesting to turn it around and say, especially since it is exponentially sensitive, when you either you get to this threshold and then have to wait over producing after that? Is it interesting to turn that around and say, okay, now we have a bound on these parameters, being on the wrong side of that, it's already rolled out.
You could try, yes.
I mean, because yes, we have some bound on oscillations coming from the other end where they're not stopping you.
Absolutely, yeah.
Making these modulations of those.
Yes.
Of the power spectrum and beyond. But this would be kind of coming at it from the other end.
Yeah. So in fact, when we started to discuss this in Benasque, part of the idea was, okay, so let's see how generic is this in action monodromy inflation, for example. And I mean, you still have to tune. It's not a free lunch.
But to get it to be right on target for.
Yes, but you might still get some bounds from what you're saying, from avoiding the overproduction, let's say, of primordial black holes. Yes.
What does it say about the
primordial? Yes. One could check this, yes.
Mm-hmm. But understand, do you literally mean this, where you have all these false minima?
Some of them are not minima. So in here, they are not minima because the depth of the minima increases as the field diminishes.
So, you've drawn something where it looks like I could trap the inflaton somewhere, right?
Well, it will.
Pockets that would never stop.
This is a cartoon. Okay, I can show you an exact potential, but it's not.
But I mean, the quantum fluctuations might fluctuate. And
No. No, you can, Peter, you can compute the.
You might have some regime like that where you can instantly roll out or something.
Well, that's what I'm asking, but is the slope always down?
The slope is always way down, and you can also compute, we estimated it in the thin wall approximation, what is the tunneling probability once you get stuck, and it's zero, okay? It's negligible. I mean, the time to tunnel is much larger than the age of the universe, so you stay in one minimum and you stay there, okay?
You can rule that out.
Forever, yes. So that's not a problem.
Oh, I just want to worry about Hubble regions being trapped. Just
you don't have to worry.
No, sorry.
Aren't you basically using this as a bunch of essentially inflection point like things?
It's the same thing, but with many minima. If you just zoom in, it's the same dynamics.
If you were happy with his original.
I'm just trying to be Paul Steinhardt and argue that if you have some really weird fluctuation that stops the inflaton there, then I just may sit there and then that region of space just ends up inflating forever. And
I see. You're saying the rare event to consider would be a PBH, but some.
Yeah, some large fluctuation.
Something that takes over the universe.
Yeah, well, it just stops the inflaton, right?
But if I'm
that'd be like a visible bubble scenario that you also entertain.
But Peter, if I'm telling you that the probability of tunneling from one minima to another, any of these, is very low because.
It's so low
that it is much longer than the age of the universe. You will also expect that during inflation, the chances of doing these jumps is also very low, right? You're talking about what? Quantum fluctuations during inflation.
If I get stuck there, then I stay there. And you end up in jumping. And then why don't I just keep inflating?
But why would you get stuck? I mean,
well, it's just a big fluctuation, right? The same reason eternal inflation happens.
It might happen somewhere, yeah, with some probability.
Right. So I want that probability to be smaller than even minus 180 or something, right? So I need none of those patterns in my past life. Otherwise, that takes over the universe, that eternal inflating patch.
Okay. I see. Okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, being able to see, to get more, even more wild, but this is kind of
a direction, but
see the multiverse, is usually kind of hard.
I just worry about having a point where classically you could just stop rolling. If I put the particle on one of those things, then it just sits there forever, right? And I'm just an exact sitter space.
But again, just from my own understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Before he was talking about, in your first example where you described an inflection point, you seemed to be having it really be a little dip in what you were saying. So already there, you might have asked
that. Well, that's right. But this cartoon just made me. So I know, I mean, it reminds me of the relaxing on thing, I guess. Right?
Yes. Yes.
And I just worry that you get stuck somewhere.
But you get stuck somewhere. It's not that inflation will end up here, okay? Inflation will end up here. I'm just adjusting the.
I'm more worried that you might end up in a distribution of places within our.
That's another thing, yes. For practical purposes, so in the potential that I wrote here, there is this value, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that I'm using it to put the zero where I want it, essentially. And then what I'm saying is that the probability of going from there to anti the sitter is negligible.
Oh, yeah. No,
that's late times. During inflation, you're telling me, yes, I understand.
I'm not worried about that.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about it.
You're asking, is during inflation a problem having so many minima? I don't know.
If I scatter a bunch of marbles down that potential, they'll end up in a distribution of.
Well, classically, you're going to end up always in the same minimum, okay?
Well, not if I start with a velocity dispersion.
No, there's no velocity dispersion because here you're in a slow roll. So the velocity is always the same. There's no velocity dispersion.
Sure.
And you're already slow rolling here, so the velocity is the same. What you might worry is whether quantum jumps could make you go to a minimum that you don't want during inflation. But that we can estimate, and I think it's very low, the probability that this happens. Again, we can check it. Okay, so anyway, I was saying that then you can think of producing the black holes during matter domination, and this is more favorable than during radiation domination. And some of the scalings change because, the universe behaves differently during matter and radiation domination.
So why does this matter? Because at the end of inflation, if I don't couple to anything else, you'll have matter domination.
Yeah, it was just an example to introduce it. Yeah.
Nothing to do with ripples here, right?
But no. It's just the fact that the minimum is quadratic. It depends on what kind of minimum you have. If you have lambda phi to the 4, then you don't. But it was just because I wanted to. I mean, so let's say the aim at the end of the talk was trying to reduce a little bit this exponential sensitivity in some way. Okay, and there are two ways you can do. One is saying, okay, I have a potential that has many minima, and therefore I don't have to play with the coefficients. And the other one is saying, I want to get it with a lower primordial power spectrum, and that is something you can do if you have a phase of matter domination before radiation. Okay, because the collapse is much more likely. So and the way you can control this is by using the reheating temperature, which also tells you how long this phase lasts, and this is correlated with the mass of the primordial black holes in this case. And not to go for very long, this is the scaling that you get for this fraction of the energy density that collapses. And as you can imagine now, due to the fact that this is exponential and this is potential, you can reduce very significantly the primordial power spectrum height that you need to get all the dark matter, okay, with such a phase. Yes.
There's another effect, though, that I think is buried in your equations.
Yes.
Deserves to be mentioned. You gain a lot of primordial, you gain a lot of F, primordial black hole, for the same beta.
Sure.
During radiation domination, because the...
Because they scale differently, yes.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you have beta domination, you lose out on that many decades.
Absolutely.
Of extra volume.
Absolutely.
So you're right, you can get beta, the same, but you can end up with a lot lower fraction.
Yes.
For the same beta because of the matter dominator.
So these two parameters are related because you want this phase to have the adequate duration. Well, yeah, you can play with the duration of this phase in such a way that the abundance of relative to that of radiation of the primordial black hole that you have produced before grows as you desire. Yeah. And this is what these plots tries to summarize. So here is the reheating temperature that, as you see, has to be pretty low, actually, of the order of, well, pretty low, moderately low, okay? Like 10 to the 5 GeV, sorry?
What's gamma?
Gamma is a number that characterizes the efficiency of the collapse.
Okay.
So how much, how, basically, it's something you put in front of this estimate of the mass that I made, just to know, but it's order 1, or order 0.1. Typically, people for radiation use 0.2, and for matter domination, they use 1. But it's not very significant. So if I put 0.1, this line will move a little bit, but not much. Okay. Now, the point of this plot is, so basically, horizontal lines here is primordial power spectrum, height of the peak. This is the reheating temperature, and these are the masses that you will get. So, in solar masses, okay. So 10^-15, for example, here, which is in the region we want. And this is the scale at which the peak has to be. And then this white triangle is the allowed region. This is ruled out by Hawking evaporation, and this one is not ruled out, but it means that the collapse will happen during the phase of radiation domination. And if you fall in here, then you see that with the spectra that are lower than the ones I was discussing before, you can still get, this is for 100% of the dark matter in primordial black holes. So you don't need to go to 10^-2, you can do it with 10^-4. This is still in the Gaussian approximation, okay? And just to summarize, so if somebody tells you that his or she is searching for primordial black holes, he or she better does in this region of mass. This is the main message. Then the formation of primordial black holes in inflation is not generic, so you have to play with it. With inflation, I mean, to get them. Simplest thing you can think is this kind of potentials. There are many implementations in the literature. Some work, some don't. I let you go and study yourself. And then you can do more fancy things, like playing with the speed of sound or the scalar fluctuations. And I think it's interesting to consider this possibility of forming the black holes during matter domination, because it may allow to reduce the degree of adjustment that you have to do, for example, in your potential. Okay. So that's it. Thank you. Yes.
I'm going to make my comment, which is not a criticism, but it's a comment on delta C, I think, or perhaps gamma, and that is that I think the assumption that these black holes are horizon-sized objects is not really yet something that we've seen from the Marabou right now. And the short argument from that is that, you know, when we collapse objects, this delta C comes from critical collapse simulations, where you have a single, generally spherically symmetric object that obeys the scaling relationships. But that's not, it's not coupled to anything else, right? And usually it's Minkowski space-time asymptotically, etc. And when you
the collapse itself is, by definition, nonlinear physics,
yeah.
Which means that all of the scales of the problem enter into the how that collapse happens. So this is what I said, you know, when you have angular momentum in the smaller scales, and those are coupled to the scale.
Where does this, which angular momentum, sorry?
There's universe in that horizon.
Well, you have radiation.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? And it has
so
properties associated with it.
So which is the angular momentum then?
Well, you have a distribution.
Inhomogeneous.
Yeah.
There are inhomogeneities in your horizon already existing.
There are
sure.
Loads in there. Right?
In scales that are much smaller than the ones corresponding to the horizon, right?
But it's a nonlinear problem, right? And so
yeah.
So you can't say that. And I think this is just my act right now, right? You can't say in a nonlinear problem that power at other scales don't matter,
mm-hmm.
especially because this peak is going to have some power at scales just smaller than it. And when we do the simulations,
mm-hmm.
we generically are not seeing collapse because of what's happening in the box under non-ideal situations.
Sorry, but what simulations? Because these are different simulations, right?
Right. So we're actually doing...
We're talking about what simulations.
Right. We're doing the numerical relativity at the end of inflation. To watch what happens when these modes enter.
But you're talking about preheating or something?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, but this is something different. I mean, what these people, the codes they have are completely, it's not like the kind of lattice codes you're using, I think, right? I mean, I think that what they are simulating is, correct me if I'm wrong, but they take some shape for these mass densities and they study essentially how they evolve over time, and they do ray tracing propagation, and when they see that the light doesn't come out, then they say I form a black hole, basically. I think that's what they are doing.
Who's they?
Well, there's a guy that has worked a lot on this who's called Ilya Musko. I don't know if you know him.
I don't. Yeah. So that's it. I live under a rock, and I don't have
right.
Any, so
okay.
Probably lots of simulations
right.
That I don't know about. But I'm in preheating,
yeah.
And we haven't worked these scales. But the argument that I'm trying to say is that in those regimes where one expected to see black holes forming during preheating,
mm-hmm.
we're seeing that the nonlinear dynamics are important, which shouldn't really be a surprise because it's GR.
Yes.
And I would expect then that the nonlinear dynamics are important here as well.
So in preheating, you mean you create power spectrum due to the instability during preheating? It's not that it has a wavelength that is, you don't have a perturbation that is entering the Hubble radius and then collapses, or you do have it?
You would in the realization, right? There are over densities and under densities that are, the horizon grows inside the thing and modes become into play.
But that's, if it's preheating, it's sub-horizon, right?
Exactly.
The amplification
yes.
is sub-horizon, or you're talking about a mode that enters the horizon already.
No, but I'm saying there are papers out there that say these modes, when they enter the horizon, right, have this kick, and you generate generically through the same mechanism, Hubble scale.
I think it is a very fundamental difference between you get a kick as you enter the horizon versus you've already had that amplitude as you enter.
I totally agree. But what I'm saying is when you do one thing and you realize that the analytics aren't capturing the nonlinear dynamics and that's a surprise, you should be ready for a surprise
in
another situation.
I mean, it did move. I remember it used to be 0.3 because an analytic estimate for delta C was always 0.3.
Right.
And these numerical relativity codes have moved it up to 0.4.
So what I'm going to say is just that when, you know, if they're created, which we all hope they are,
yeah.
I don't think you're going to get a delta function of a mass distribution function, because that gamma or whatever, or delta M, I would not be surprised if it was a decade or two decades wide. And I think that has an effect on when we're being back.
Sure. So
that's my,
yeah.
my comment is,
okay.
I think it's a nonlinear problem, and
yeah.
and there's this is what we can do,
yeah.
and it's great. But once we do the simulations, I think we'll be surprised.
So in this sense, so first of all, it's not even clear that, leaving aside the non-Gaussianities, it's not even clear that this simplified description by which I say if I have a fluctuation that is bigger than whatever, I will form a black hole is a neat description, okay? You may have to worry about things like, for example, as you said, the shape of the power spectrum itself, that may play a role. Even this Precht sector-like description that I'm doing, people say may not be accurate enough, that you can perhaps do it better if you use something that is called peaks theory, which is a different way of counting the statistics of peaks. So all these things, people are working on them. I mean, but in the end, all of them basically tell you that in radiation domination, the amount of amplitude that you need is order 10 to the minus 2. Now, whether these black holes do really form or not, I haven't done the simulations. The people that do them, they are very convinced, but of course they are probably biased. So all I can tell you is try to do them and check it. I didn't.
All right, well, maybe we should continue the discussion at Copies and Pythons.
Okay. Thank you.